Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery, and it's brought to you by our friends at Reprieve Recovery. It's an all-women's center up in Morgan, Utah. Beautiful Morgan, Utah.
Beautiful. It's the best place in Utah.
That's where you grew up.
That is where I grew up.
And here's the crazy thing, and I'm not going to throw Morgan under the bus, but I'm going to throw Morgan under the bus.
Good luck.
When they started to build the recovery center up there,
yeah,
there was a lot of backlash.
True.
There was a lot of people coming out and saying, hey,
we don't like the outsiders.
We don't want this in our neighborhood. Yeah. We don't want this around our kids, and we don't want this.
George Carlin story? Yeah,
NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees we need more prisons. Everyone agrees we need more recovery centers. Everyone agrees we need more hospitals.
Right.
All of those stuff, but nobody wants it in their backyard.
Exactly.
So Morgan was like, we're not going to do this. They're going to fight them tooth and nail, and Reprieve Recovery won.
Well, they do that with normal businesses too, by
yeah,
the way.
No, yeah, and I know that, and it's kind of that small town.
That's why it's still a small town.
Small town mentality.
But there were enough people
yeah.
that said, okay, right?
Well, they also had the law on their side.
Well, that too.
You know, and there was, you know, that was kind of really helping them push through. But what's crazy is that I wanted to go up and talk to the city council and say, you'd be surprised. We've been doing this podcast for 5 years. How many people we've had on our podcast.
Disproportionately.
From your small town.
Yeah, we have.
And so that's the thing.
One of my classmates we grew up with, she's doing great.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of Morganites.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
And that just shows the point that, I mean, this is not a big city problem.
No.
This is not, an East Coast, West Coast problem. This is not a Hollywood problem. This is a societal problem, and it's happening everywhere.
Everywhere. Small towns, big towns, everything.
And but you used to be able, it goes back to the stigma of the whole disease. Right. Nobody ever knew how bad it really was because nobody was ever open with it. I remember when I was a kid.
Shame, right?
Yeah, shame. And when you were a kid, like, you'd be like, hey, where did Johnny go? It was all like, he just went to go hang out with his uncle,
Up
in Idaho.
Working on a potato farm.
He's
really at rehab.
A rehab. Or he went down south and, he's just, because nobody wanted to admit that it was happening in their household or to their neighbor or to their family member or to their loved one. And I think now we're much more open to having the conversation.
Yeah.
But it's still a huge stigma around.
A lot of misunderstanding about what it is and what it isn't and how we treat it. But it's getting better.
And that brings me up to what I wanted to talk about today.
Well, what was their website?
ReprieveRC.com.
Oh, there you go.
Go check them out and you can get all the information there. But you tell me this, Dr. Matt, because my life is an open book. And I talk about things that are going on in my life with my kids, with my ex-wife, with my parents, my brothers, whatever. But when if you bring up to somebody that you're seeing a therapist,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times people's first inclination is, well, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, and people are like, well, there's got to be something wrong with you. And there's a lot of people who are going to see a therapist who there's not necessarily anything wrong with, but things could be better. If understood, what they're dealing
100%,
with.
100%. People get either uncomfortable or interested, but there's often the assumption that there's, I didn't know that there was something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I had a conversation in therapy with a woman yesterday, and she even did that. She started off, she said, I appreciate you seeing me. I'm like, well, of course, I've been seeing you for a while now. It's no problem. And she's like, well, I feel like you probably see people with much more severe, my problems aren't that bad and I feel bad taking up your time. And we had to have a conversation about like, well, is this time valuable? Is it helpful to you? She said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I said, over the time we've been working together, have you been able to work some things through that you hadn't been able to do on your own? She said, yes. Have you learned some skills that you feel like you use regularly to improve your life and relationships? She said, yes. I said, so wouldn't it be great if everybody could use some help that way?
Yes.
Right? Because I know I can and have at times, and I know you have. And so you don't have to have something that's putting you in the hospital before you go get help. In fact, that's the worst model possible for mental health and substance abuse recovery is let's wait until there's a major problem and then try to go fix it. Why don't we get out ahead of things and try to go work on things before they become a major problem? Or if you wanted to get good at playing the piano, what would you do?
I would take lessons.
Right. And you wouldn't wait until you had a recital and then try to sneak in a lesson the day before, would you? Well, you might, but maybe. I mean, the regular person,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's kind of the analogy is like a lot of people, they're like, well, I'm fine. I'm okay. I'll wait till there's a tragedy or a crisis and then I'll go in and get some help. And that's the old medical model and it works great for medicine, but it's not a great model for us.
I you know, when you say the term medical or mental health, yeah. There's a lot of negativity that surrounds
stigma,
that.
Sure.
But why? Because
thankfully a lot of people are talking about the importance of improving one's mental health ever since COVID. I think it's become just part of the lexicon. Everybody's talking about that. So I hope over the next decade that becomes just as important as dental health and physical health and mental health. They're all the same.
Like my fitness is very important to me in my recovery. And in order to stay in great shape, I have to go to the gym.
And you go every day?
I go every day. Yeah. And my mental health is very important to me in my recovery. Mm-hmm. And so a therapist is just like a gym for your brain. I mean, to go in there and work some things out and talk some stuff out, because anyone who tells you they have all the answers is full of
garbage.
Yes. Yep. Because nobody has all the answers. And I'm 50 years old and I'm still trying to figure out who I am and what I'm all about. And anybody who knows exactly who they are and what they're all about is lying to you.
So you're paraphrasing Carl Rogers, the famous psychologist who said, life is becoming.
Yes.
And the happiest, healthiest people are always in the process of becoming. Yeah.
I tell my kids all the time, I go, life is a journey. It's not about the destination. It's about the journey and where you go along that route and what you learn and who you meet and what goes on. That's what it's about.
Yeah. I just had a brilliant $1 million book idea.
Let's
for
do
you.
It.
Meme Dad.
Meme Dad.
That's you 100%.
Meme Dad. Yep. Because you know, if nothing changes, nothing changes.
There you go. Absolutely. You know,
our guest here, Mark Pepper, who's been sober for 21 years.
Which, by the way, can we just talk about how cool of a name that is?
Wait till you hear his voice.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got that gravitas. He's got that gravelly voice. And,
yeah.
You know, and he just speaks with just so such elegance. You must be like an English professor or something.
I bet you have a degree in English.
Yes, something like that.
So he's been
is
sober.
Is that how I started? That's the beginning.
That's pretty
good.
Okay, well, there you go. He's been sober for 21 years. And I'm guessing on your 21-year journey, you've learned a few things about addiction, mental health, rehab, in and outpatients, all that kind of stuff.
Correct. A lot of things.
And we're going to find out more about that in just a second. But one of my favorite memes when it comes to recovery is this, Dr. Pepper or Mr. Pepper or
Mark is great.
Okay. the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. And to me, that so beautifully illustrates what active addiction is for me. Because I was doing the same thing over and over again, and every day I was expecting a different outcome. And nothing changes if nothing changes, and I wasn't changing anything.
Yeah, and what's coming to my mind is even in sobriety, if we're doing the same things and not getting results, but continue to do them, that's insanity too. I don't think it takes a drug addict or alcoholic to repeat the same behaviors over and over, expecting change.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see a lot of people that get sober and they think, well, I just stopped drinking and I'll just stay stopped. And it's still insane.
Yeah. And then they call that a dry drunk because now they're just miserable or they're not using their substance. And I've seen so many people who go back to it and go, I got sober and life didn't change.
Right.
And so I might as well be drunk.
Which is also the insanity. It's
just
the other side of that coin to me is you don't have to be using to be trying the same. I was told if I don't drink, everything will get better. That's not really the experience. For an alcoholic, when I stop drinking, nothing really gets better. It gets worse.
Yeah.
Unless I have a replacement for that or some things to...
Because you still have the problems.
Still have the problems.
That might have been part of the reason you drank in the first place.
And I still have the disease of alcoholism today.
Right.
It's
right.
In full remission, but I got to treat that.
I love it. You're going to hear Mark Pepper's story coming up. You're listening to Project Recovery. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. Our guest today is Mark Pepper, who's got 21 years of sobriety underneath his belt. But where does the story of Mark Pepper begin?
Probably at the beginning.
Sure. We don't have to go all the way back to conception.
I forgot about that.
That'd be okay. A different kind of show.
I try to hearken back, but I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Born in Salt Lake.
Okay.
Raised here. Was adopted into a family with two biological sisters that are both biological kids of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an older sister. They adopted me, and I have a younger sister. And I don't know how important that is other than that for me, I didn't really fit in the family, to me, that I'm an outcast. I'm a boy. I'm adopted. I'm in the middle.
Did you know at what age were you adopted?
Well, my parents have never agreed on that. One, I think, said 10 months and one 18 months.
Okay.
And I might be wrong about that.
But they never kept that from you. They told you.
I knew it all the time, and I don't know if I was I was not a newborn when I was adopted. I'd spent some time apparently maybe in an orphanage.
But you're not sure. But they never kept a secret.
I always knew I was adopted.
And I don't want to sound.
That is kind of a triple threat of difference.
Which is as it fueled my addiction. It was perfect fuel
excuse
for that.
Yeah. But I mean, if you think about it, I talk with kids who had a conversation with a new person the other day who's adopted, and even under the best of circumstances, there's curiosity there. I have two nieces and a nephew that are adopted, and it does make you, not necessarily even in a bad way, but feel a little bit different.
Right.
And then you're the only boy and you're in the middle. So, I mean, those are three big things.
I grew up Jewish in Salt Lake City.
Oh, okay.
So quadruple. That's the four. I got more, but that's...
bingo card's getting full.
It's getting full. And I...
alcoholic bingo card.
So I'm not really fitting in
in
school, in my peer group, at home, although I had a loving home. Just felt different. And grew up playing sports. I was real active and mediocre at sports, just enough to make a team and maybe contribute a little bit. Played high school basketball and tennis and some field events. And so wanted the chameleon stuff started where I wanted to be friends with the Mormon kids,
mm-hmm.
and the popular kids and the jocks, and I'd started smoking pot, so the stoners. So I kind of wore a mask. I didn't know any of this at the time, but I wanted everyone to like me. And if someone had asked me that, I would have said, I don't care if anyone likes me, but I really cared if people liked me, and I didn't know any of that.
So when you first started smoking weed, was it to fit in, or was it curiosity, or was it both?
All of that. And I had a buddy that just offered up some weed, and I drank. There was alcohol in our home. It was part of religious stuff, and it was, I tasted it as a little boy. I liked it. I didn't know I liked it, but there was like a warm feeling.
But it wasn't considered because
I wasn't drinking.
But a lot of homes here in the state of Utah, alcohol is forbidden.
Right.
And so for you, it wasn't like a forbidden fruit. It was around, and
there was wine. There was probably an alcohol cabinet,
uh-huh.
and I didn't sample that stuff as a little boy.
It was a fermented fruit.
We'd have a little bit of wine on Friday nights or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But the first time I drank till I blacked out and got sick, and I was probably 13.
And after that first drunk, because I too have had one of those, I said, well, this sucks. I don't want to do this again.
That was not my reaction. I was like, this is great. I want to do that again, including the headache and the spinning, and like all of it was fantastic. Mostly because while I was doing that, I was connecting really well with my new buddies.
Mm-hmm. And Mark's crazy. Mark's fun. Mark's all these
things. Right. I was funny. I was fun. They're funny. They're fun. But I liked that. And I soon found weed. And those two were 13 to 16 kind of constant companions whenever I could drink and always smoked.
And we've had people who've sat in that chair where you're sitting right there that says, you know, after that first drink or that first smoke or that first Oxycontin, whatever it may be, they knew that this was going to be their jam. Did you think it was going to be your jam?
I wasn't conscious of that, although I really liked it and sought it out.
Mm-hmm.
I was more like, I want to do well in school. I want to play sports. I was kind of driven. I did really well in school my whole life. I don't know that I was smart, but it came easy, but school was important. Learning was exciting to me. Drugs were exciting. Like, I kind of got turned on pretty easily.
So it sounds like you had a pretty typical high school. I mean,
feels like that.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that the TV shows and movies celebrate, you know what I mean? You
experimented. The stoner, the smart kid.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, and I don't know.
But never got in any real trouble in school or with the cops or your parents because of it?
No, I got talked to a lot by the cops, but never in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
High school was no trouble.
So then you graduate high school.
Well, let me ask you this first. So how did you feel socially? So here you are, you're excelling in kind of everything you do, including hanging out with the stoners. Because you're involved in everything, I assume you had friends in all those groups. Did you actually feel like, oh, I'm included, I'm definitely one of the gang? Did you have a positive social experience, or did you still feel a little bit like an outsider?
I think at the time I did. Mm-hmm. I think looking back, I didn't. And I don't know which is true, but I felt like I was okay. If I had just a little bit of pot in me, I was fine with anybody. When I was not able to find marijuana, I wasn't very happy.
Okay.
And I alcohol and then cocaine, which are kind of the three primary drugs that I used.
Cocaine even in high school?
In high school, I started at 16 and stopped at 39.
You know, I think what you're describing is something we see a lot on the show, and probably you've seen in your work as a therapist, that people who have that, like you said, I got turned on pretty easily. You get excited about things. You're curious minded. You want to try things. You have enthusiasm for everything, whether it's school or drugs or whatever. Those folks tend to kind of go big with drug use.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, and again, unconsciously, right? It's interesting to look back and to talk about it. And because in the moment, I was just a kid. I was just like, I'm just growing up normally. This is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't think, am I happy? Am I okay? Very often, I fit in well enough, and I think I had a lot of friends because I could get drugs and alcohol. I think that helped me socially. It
does make you popular.
I could buy beer, and I could drive to Evanston and do that stuff. And I was happy to buy friends. I was content having friends that needed me because I had alcohol and drugs.
We've talked about it on the podcast before. In that party circle, that group, your only currency to get invited or welcomed into that group is either a willingness to do it or
bringing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And anybody's welcome.
I brought
both. Yeah. And anybody's welcome. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter who you are, whatever you are. If you're like, well, you snort this, come on in.
Right.
You got some, come on in. And that's it.
Yep. So that went all right. You know, that was, again, normal. I graduated high school. I was looking to go to college. I grew up in a household where it wasn't, are you going to college? It's like, where are you going to college? And I applied to some schools. I didn't tell my parents very much about this. I was living with my dad, and I had applied. I got accepted to Stanford University.
Wow.
Got a scholarship to a university in Queensland, Australia. And I ended up going to Eugene, Oregon. I went to the U of O my first year of college, which was my senior year of high school. I had matriculated early. So I was a smart guy, right? And I kind of rode on that a little bit.
Sounds like you said, driven too. That's a lot of work.
Kind of driven for school, but I didn't take any of the challenges really with college and was like, Eugene will be nice.
Laid
it's
back.
Not going to be Stanford. It's not going to be, you know.
Did that factor in your choice of choosing Eugene over Stanford?
I don't know.
Because of the rigor?
I don't really remember.
Yeah.
But I ended up there for a year, and I got my next addiction that followed me most of my adult life, which was depression. And I want to identify it as an addiction rather than a mental health condition for me.
Because that's the first time I've ever heard that, and I was going to actually stop you. And can you be addicted to depression?
So I know I can. I know the feeling I got from the self-pity and the darkness and the heaviness was very intoxicating, as hard and sad as it was. And I challenge a lot of people I work with, like there appears to be an attraction to self-pity and depression and an addiction sense to that, like there is drugs and alcohol. And we'll open our eyes and be like, oh, I never thought about that before. And it's true for me. Because I get sober and I find a program that helps me recover from alcoholism, and it turns out I'm not depressed. But I caught it in Eugene. It was rainy. It was dark. Hard liquor was coming on board, and it was perfect for me. It was a perfect mix for me to like. I loved. It felt great. I was like writing poetry in the graveyard.
Tortured soul.
Tortured soul.
Poetry
tortured
in the graveyard.
Oh,
yeah,
so that's romantic.
Heavy stuff. Yeah.
and wanted to, you know, hadn't thoughts of hurting myself. I never did.
Listening to the Smiths.
Oh, God. Just lovely, dark, The Cure, you know, just the worst music. But it got dark, right? And so I felt I didn't know any different, right? It's just...
There is something intoxicating. I like how you said that about moodiness.
Yeah.
About that romantic side of things. And you meet people sometimes, and I think maybe I can relate to that a little bit when I was a teenager, like that feeling of wanting to be moody and dark. And
Winona Ryder and Beetlejuice.
Yeah, all that sort of gothic, you know, stuff that can't be from your heavy emotional experience as a teenager, a young adult.
And that's fueled by alcohol. And to me, it was like, man, I mean, all the best artists are alcoholics.
Well, all the poets, greatest, you know, Edgar Allan Poe and all the great writers.
Yeah. So I fancy myself those guys at night. You know, my ego's out of control. I mean, I hate myself kind of, but I'm like, I'm better than all these other sort of that egomania with inferiority complex.
Hemingway, what has he got on you, right?
We'll find out, right? I'll just say once I get writing.
Yeah.
So I did that for a year, and I remember there used to be a magazine called Playboy. I don't know about it now. They had really good articles.
Yeah.
And one of them annually was the top 20 party schools in America. Mm. And I had told myself that spring that whatever was number one, I'm transferring to that school. This is a 18-year-old brain without any adult supervision. I didn't check in with a grown-up.
Yeah.
I sort of was making these decisions on my own, and I transferred to the University of Colorado in Boulder.
That was number one.
Which in 1982 was that.
Okay.
And then it got going.
Were you looking for like the Animal House type experience?
I got it. Oh. I found it. I joined a fraternity in Boulder, and I lived with 70 guys that drank and did drugs like I did.
Wow.
And I too was in a fraternity.
Yeah, and I don't. As we're talking about this, it sounds maybe some glorification, and I don't. It was dark. I mean, I had friends in that house that worried about me early on. I'm 20 years old, 19. They're like, "You drink too much, dude. You do too many."
When the fraternity
drugs.
Brothers are telling you drink too much,
and that was the first inclination from my party buddies, at probably 19 or 20, that I didn't drink normally or do. I mean, I don't know that anyone does cocaine for three straight days normally, but I loved cocaine. I just did mad love. That would probably be the one love of all the stuff that I did was cocaine.
So you're down there, your fraternity brothers are saying, hey, maybe you drink too much. Yeah. At any point, is your family back at home wondering about you, or are you just kind of away from them, out of sight, out of mind?
Kind of that, although I'd been told by both my parents as a teenager that they were worried about my drinking. I'm like, you don't have any idea what I'm doing. I just was dismissive of loving parents, right? Mm-hmm. Just that you don't know. Lived with my grandparents, I was pretty shifty.
Well, and that's a manipulative part of the disease. And
I didn't want them to know.
Yeah.
I didn't want me to know. I was not being honest either, and I couldn't have been.
Yeah.
I just had 20 more years of really bad times coming up.
So how does the rest of your college career go?
So those guys were so worried, I decided I was going to move to London for a year and get sober.
Oh.
First effort at getting sober, and I wasn't sober for a minute.
Why London?
Well, I spoke the language. I wanted to leave the country, and I didn't have a cocaine dealer in London. I thought I would be far enough away from like the problem, because the coke dealer was the problem.
Yeah.
Right, before I knew anything. And I go and I start drinking, and I can't stop drinking, and come home, go back to school, finish college. And I finished college while living in San Francisco. I'd gotten a job as a guide dogs for the blind dog instructor. And because by this point I didn't like people very much. I had my depression and my selfness was just so grand. I just wanted to be with that. Like, I love animals. So I go and I get a job in San Rafael, California. And the problem with having done like five or six geographics by 22 years old is that I just kept showing up, and the drinking and the drugging just kept continuing. And mm-hmm. I couldn't keep jobs, couldn't keep. Grateful Dead were on tour for those 20 of those years. I did a lot of Grateful Dead shows.
Looking for a miracle.
I found it. I found that. I never had a bad, I was hoping, I know when Jerry Garcia died, I thought, all of my good times drinking and using are over, because those times were good. Other than that, it was not really good. It was.
Did you like that community of the dead?
Like the community, I could party freely. Yeah. I could be myself. I love the music. I like the being a completely.
Well, I think it's a connection, right? It's a community. It's a connection, and I like what you said. I think a lot of people, when they find a community, they feel maybe like this is where I can be myself.
Right.
But I want to stop you. Because was that yourself? Because it sounds like you didn't know who you were and you didn't like. Or do you think nobody would call you out or knew who you should be?
Well, I like that question, because earlier on we talked about like growing, you know, becoming who we are. Mm-hmm. And I'm 60 and I don't know yet. So that's for sure not who I really was. I'm becoming now. I'm much closer today. But at the time, I didn't know any of that. And I liked the environment. And I drank too much. I mean, I took a lot of hallucinogenics. I just did a lot of drugs. I'm kind of excited to get to the recovery piece, because as I talk, I feel kind of bad for that kid.
Yeah.
I was lost as hell, and I didn't know it. If anyone had asked me, my confidence was high. My self-esteem was low.
Living your best life.
Well, that's sort of a facade of competency, right? Like,
for sure.
You know, we're trying to build that up on the outside.
But that's my point. And he goes, you know, I could be myself. Well,
that wasn't
really
me. Right, right. Well, and I didn't know. I'd never really been.
I think people try to talk themselves into believing that facade, right? I am the confident person. You don't need to tell me what to do. I know what I'm doing. And that allows you to be in a state of essentially self-delusion.
Correct. And without even, well, it's sort of in the definition, right? Like, I didn't even know that I was delusional about that stuff. I thought I was fine.
So you're bouncing around, you're following the dead, you've gone to 5 different states, you crossed the pond because you didn't have a drug dealer there, you end up graduating, and then where does Mark's life go?
I stay in San Francisco for a while, bounce around jobs. I start helping, getting jobs where I'm helping people. I work for like group homes, helping kids. I moved back to Salt Lake for a brief period of time. I don't really remember what was going on there, but got into helping kids. Moved back to the Bay Area, late 20s by now, maybe early 30s, and I meet my first wife in San Francisco. My mom sets us up on a blind date, and I met her, and her family had a great deal of money, and I grew up pretty upper class in Salt Lake, and I'd never seen this before, and was doing lots of cocaine, which is, by the way, really expensive, and again, unconsciously, was very drawn to that. I wasn't drawn to her so much, which is hard to say, but drawn to that life that was possible with that, with cars, homes, travel, drugs, right? And sort of the freedom to be free, to not have to steal anymore to get money.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a big part of the story from my father. Stole a lot of money from my dad over the years. And so we get married, and I go to my first rehab, early 30s in that marriage. And
did you go because you needed help, or it was an ultimatum? Or?
Yep, all that. I needed help.
Yeah.
I would not have gone on my own. My sister did a little intervention. I'm going to let dad know about all this. I'm going to, like, you're out, dude. Your cocaine use is, I know what's up. Mm. I was thankful, grateful. Went to Center City, Minnesota, Hazelden. I didn't know what Hazelden was at the time. I knew I needed, again, on my own, I'm like, I should probably leave Utah. Not a great idea, but I didn't consult. I was talking to my wife at the time. She's like, yeah, I'll go. So went there for 30 days, and my dad and my wife at the time flew out, went to family week, family day, whatever's going on. They were involved. It was great. And then I left there and I didn't know what to do. And I'm sure they gave me an aftercare plan that I don't recall or didn't. I knew what to do when, like, a band I liked was playing at the Zephyr. I knew what to do.
Right.
So I went and saw them
and
assured my wife I'd be sober, and wasn't. Right. And so it was like 4 days after I got home. Which is my entire experience in rehab. I never stayed sober in or after rehab one time. And I went to a lot of rehab. So my 30s were just that.
In and out of rehab.
In and out of rehab.
Broken
and relationships.
Promises.
We divorced. She ultimatumed me, like, it's either me or the cocaine. And I mean, this is almost the most painful. Like, that was a no-brainer for me. I could imagine life without her. I could not imagine life without cocaine.
How heavy is that statement?
It breaks my heart to think of that human being that I would say that to, that I would, like, look her in the eye. I'm like, you're crazy. Like, it's cocaine. I made a choice. I don't really have a choice.
You know, my statement to match that one is, I fought harder to keep alcohol in my life than I did for anything else.
It's amazing that there's human beings involved. And again, the man I am now can't imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I'm like, that's not a very smart question, honey.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, the answer's not going to be very nice. And I don't say that lightly. Like, it's,
I can feel our emotion. Yeah.
And so, I was probably 32. I don't remember the ages, but the darkness got darker and the suicidality got much more profound.
Any legal trouble throughout the thing?
DUI back when I was 24. I mean, it's kind of a blip. It was like the cop's fault, and I drank the next day. I mean, I drank and drove without a license the next week.
Yeah.
I didn't, like, no consequence. I'm Mark effing Pepper.
Yeah.
Right, don't you know?
Yeah.
And but I got a wake-up call from that for a minute, and then I drank because I couldn't not drink. I could not go without alcohol and drugs.
So you're 32 and it starts to get darker. Suicidology breaks.
Yeah, and I'm looking for sort of a way to get out without hurting my family and without, you know, I do the wrong drugs to overdose. I don't never done opiates really. I don't shoot drugs. I mean, I smoke cocaine and snort it and do alcohol, and those are really not the easiest ways to kill yourself.
Mm-mm.
I'm not a gun owner. I'm not a slasher. I don't really have a way out. And in my first marriage, we owned a nice big home up in the top of the avenues, and shortly thereafter, I had the slide was fast. I was living in a room in a ski bum's house on Creek Road, and these 20-year-old kids asked me to move out. They were afraid I was going to die. Lived at Pioneer Park for a period of time, and that wasn't the bottom. That wasn't the end, right? So the outwardness of my life was the bottom, right? When I lived at the park, I was encouraged to go. I'd been to a couple other rehabs. Was encouraged to go to the VOA detox. I don't know what you know about that, but it's a low-bottom, county-funded social detox where you ride it out. No meds. There's a bunch of beds on a floor. There were back in 99, 98. And you sit there and you ride it out, and you hopefully you live, right?
If it's white-knuckle it.
White-knuckle it with 40 other dudes white-knuckling it. And I remember looking at that place. A good friend of mine worked there. And I was living at the park, and he's like, come, we got to get you some help. And I go over there, and I'm like, these losers, man, it's not that bad. And he's just looking at me like,
you're living at the park, bro.
I had a car. I was,
oh,
and I had a key to a warehouse. I mean, I was living good. Just the delusion is amazing, right? And I think about people I know that live at the park. I don't know them, but I see people.
Yeah.
And I want to just be like, dude, let's go. There's help. There is help.
Yeah.
And so I'm getting close to the end. I go to my last treatment center, The Haven, which is a sort of a low-bottom, county-funded, guys from prison, guys from jail, guys from the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I again, my ego is like, I'm at the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. They don't even have a chef.
They were about to get one because I was there. No, I... Yeah, they don't have a chef. No one cleans up but you. No one makes, there's no doctors. It's a therapeutic community. Best thing that ever happened. Like, really great treatment because it introduced me to AA.
Mm-hmm.
They had five meetings in-house a week, and we went out to two a week. And I was there for 89 days and got acclimated to AA in Salt Lake. And I hated it, and I hated those guys. They were laughing and having fun, and you know, poor me. And
were you still pretty depressed at this
really
time?
Depressed. This is in 99 to 2000. I got there right after the millennium. Mm-hmm. And I used drugs when I was there. I got a pass and went to my cocaine dealers and got drugs, and I was using it for probably my last month there. And I was like more sad because I knew that, like, this was my kind of my last chance of treatment, and I can't even stay clean and I'm a different case. I think it's the depression that's worse than it, not the drug addiction. Like I felt like I was sort of a garden variety alcoholic and drug addict who did a ton of drugs and alcohol, but I was the saddest guy. Like, don't you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was happy to let you know how hard it was and how sad. And one of the staff there, I remember her well, she scared the crap out of me. She was a big woman, and she's told me that they weren't going to put up with my self-pity anymore. And I was like, I'm clinically depressed. She's like, you need to go downstairs, and it's a dorm-style room, probably 10 beds. You need to get on your knees and pray to God to remove your depression. I'm like, I don't believe in God. She's like, I didn't ask you if you believed in God. I told you to go downstairs and pray. Or you can leave and go back to the park. So I tried that, and I didn't believe it, and I didn't understand any of it, and I haven't wanted to kill myself almost from that day till now.
Hmm.
Like, the depression wasn't all the way gone, but it lessened just dramatically. And it was just fascinating. Like, it was a moment of like, I mean, it took me a couple of days to look back and realize I hadn't really wanted to kill myself for a few days.
Hmm.
But it was rather profound mm-hmm. in my life, right? Like, I didn't equate it to the prayer directly. I wasn't putting that stuff together quite yet, but that was profound.
That's amazing.
So it wasn't immediately obvious to you that taking that action was part of the reason, but you later...
It lifted.
Yeah.
That piece of like, I'd be better off not here. My family would be better off without me. Those thoughts were gone. Like the intrusive thoughts were gone.
The dark cloud above your head got a little lighter.
Little lighter. I still was sad, and because my circumstances were horrible. I mean, I would be sad for most people. Like, it was sad. But it wasn't the like debilitating suicidal depression. Gone. So as my story goes, like, I remember how powerful prayer is. And I don't want to – someone's like, dude, you're going to be like a God-loving man. Like, I think you got the wrong guy. So, but I recall that, and I've tapped into that a lot as a sober guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm about to get sober in this story. I leave the Haven. My life gets a little better. I'm still using cocaine regularly and drinking occasionally. And I'm about to go to 2 years of rehab. I kind of silently, I'm like, you need to be locked away for a while.
So you're going to sign yourself up for 2 year rehab.
Prescott, Arizona, the Prescott house. And I'm on the phone with the guy. He's like, great. We have like from detox all the way down to like you're part of the community, and we have jobs, and we have a moving company, and we have a mm-hmm. bakery, and
kind of like the other side here.
Other or the side, Red Barn. Yeah, that's that kind of thing. Before the, like, I didn't.
Yeah.
I'm like, 2 years is probably a good start for a guy. Like, I can't get sober in a 90
sure.
day. So I'm about to go there, and I meet a woman, which is also part of all of my story of like, this woman, I can get sober now. I don't need rehab. I met a woman.
Love is going to cure it.
Love or the gym or a good job or anything outside of me doing any work is going to cure that. And she had a little six-year-old, this cute little girl, and I'm like, oh, this will be great. And so I call the Prescott house and say, I'm not coming. And we move in together, and I'm like, I don't know what she saw. She has this beautiful daughter, and then we get pregnant. And this is first time, I'm 38 years old, never had a kid, right? So I'm like, oh, this is, I don't know if we didn't know if we really wanted to be together. We decided we wanted to keep the kid, but weren't sure if we wanted to be together. And so I lived with her and her little girl for the pregnancy. And then at about 7 months pregnant, she found out I was lying again about my drinking and using, which I always did.
Yeah.
And she left. And that was October 9th of 2002. And it was a Wednesday night. And I'm sitting on the bed. So I was living in a home. It wasn't homeless. I had a job, part-time job, which was a lot for me. And she's driving off with her little kid.
Mm. And your baby.
And my baby. And I'm like, oh my God. I just remember the despair and the bewilderment and terror. Here you are again, and you're 30, like you're 39 years old. You're like an adult man. And a couple of my buddies were at a meeting that night, an AA meeting in the Foothill group. And I went up there and I was sad, and she caught me and I'm in trouble again. And they're laughing, and like they do in AA, and they're having a good time. And that was the last day I drank and used.
That was the last day.
That was it. October 9th. My sober date's October 10th, 2002.
Wow.
And I didn't know that would be it. I would have drank a lot more the night before. but it was it. And yeah.
What was it about that meeting?
I'd been to that meeting a lot. I don't know that it was that. It was the next day I got up and went to meetings, which I was going to a lot of AA over the couple of years from the Haven till then.
Mm-hmm.
And lying and taking dirty chips and not, you know, and then I'd get caught and I'd come out and tell my, you know, how I used, drank, whatever. I know that there's a theory that we can't get sober for other people. I don't quite ascribe to that. I think wanting to be part of that family was powerful.
Mm.
I don't think it would be enough to keep me sober, but it sure helped me get sober.
Mm-hmm.
So I got sober. It was like, and was feeling better, right? And was being honest and telling the truth. And she came back, and that little dude was born. When I was 2 months sober. And what a life. And he's 21 now, and just we have this relationship that's, he's the only blood human I know on the earth that I'm related to. Because I don't know my bio family. And a couple years later, I adopt that little girl. And she's my daughter. And God, so family is really important to me. And I think being a sober dad is probably the thing I do the best. My kids would tell me I'm a great dad. And I got a lot of good examples around me of great dads. So get sober. I stay sober. I get a job at a rehab. The guy that worked at the VOA, kind of want to stay emotional. It felt good.
Yeah.
It's all of it. So he opened a treatment center called Renaissance Ranch in maybe 01. They're still around, and I'm love those guys. And he's like, do you want to do a rec group on Wednesday, one day a week? I'm like 9 months sober. I'm like, one day a week's about my speed for a job.
Yeah.
I could tell my family I have a job. I could go to work on Wednesday afternoon. So I go do that. And the next day he's like, our house manager used, they're up in Park City. Do you want to be the house manager? I'm like, what does that guy do? Cooks for the guys and fixes stuff around the house. I'm like, I don't know how to cook and I don't know how to fix stuff. I'll take it. So I started working there and loved it and loved working in rehab and I love alcoholics. I loved them when I was drinking, love them now. It's kind of who I hang out with. So I'm working, and this guy's brother that worked there was the clinical director, and I used to do drugs with this guy.
Are we talking about Preston and Tyson?
No, before these guys. Okay. HR and Steve Brown.
Because both those guys have been on the podcast too, but yeah.
Yeah. This is the guy that started Renaissance before those dudes.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at this guy, and I'm probably making $9.50 an hour, but as happy as I've been in a long time. I'm like, man, I'm of purpose and value to these guys. I'm going to work. I'm starting to support my family and myself for the first time. And I look at Steve, and he's kind of a knucklehead. I mean, it's just a dude I used to party with.
Yeah.
I'm like, he's probably making, I made up like 40 bucks an hour, and I'm making 950. I should probably do that. Mm-hmm. And the only value of finishing college was that I could just go to grad school. That was the best for me, because I was 20 years later, and I went and got a master's degree in professional counseling, and I've worked in rehabs ever since then.
Wow.
And still do. And
more than one day a week.
Well, I don't, my owner, my boss might not. Yeah, I don't work very hard. I'm not really wired to work very hard, but I work a lot.
And quality over quantity.
I like my work, and I love it. And I've dedicated my work life to helping people, and I didn't know that. I didn't know that would be.
But you were kind of drawn to that from even from the beginning, right? Yeah. Like you definitely are the first and only person to ever say they had a job training dogs for the blind.
Yep.
But not many of you. But like all your early jobs, even when you were partying in San Francisco, you were drawn to helping people. You came back to Salt Lake and started working with kids.
Yeah.
I find that there was something there.
Yeah, it's a thing for sure. And it's turned out that gives me a lot of purpose and meaning, which I think drives the way I do my work too with my clients. Is like what I just think finding how we can feel valued. And find purpose.
A lot of people don't, that's authentic, though. Yeah. And I think that, you know, when I've heard feedback, I work at the University of Utah, and we are really trying hard to invite feedback from people that receive services there. And one of the things that seems to be the most meaningful is when they feel that authentic connection with their clinician, whatever professional they happen to be. And I think that somebody like you, who's always been drawn to helping people, I imagine bring that to those client experiences.
Well, thank you. I'm having a really good time being a therapist. I've stopped taking myself so seriously in my office, which has benefited my clients greatly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of levity in life good. And in therapy, and I like that because I think life's serious. It can be, and it's like it is. We don't need to be serious. It can be serious, and we don't need to be. And I like that balance in all of my life. It's sort of how my relationships are.
But I think a huge component in the recovery world that doesn't get as much attention as it should is the service part of it. Service is huge for those of us. People ask me why I do this podcast or why I answer people on Facebook. I go, because somebody answered for me. And that was the promise I made. Yeah. And I will share my knowledge and what I can do to help out because I know what somebody did for me. And without that, I wouldn't be here today. And so Dr. Matt says all the time that, you know, he doesn't come from a world of addiction, but he's always amazed at the people who sit down in that chair where you're at, the good things that they're doing in the community. I mean, I am too.
And I think of, there's one particular guy, my first sponsor, that really helped me, that my family for years would have said, that's the guy that saved Mark's life, mm-hmm. right? And I look at him that way, and I'm still close to him. And I think of the ripple effect that he spent a lot of time with me and went through the big book and the 12 steps. And I think of the number of people I've come in contact with in my professional and recovery life because he helped me. And there may be one dude I've helped that's helped. I mean, I'm sure at least 1,000 men have I, particularly men, but women too, that I've had some impact on there, like a ton of people. And I don't know, some of them think I'm no good, that I'm not helpful. But I think there have been some that we, to your point of like, my addiction rippled out, my family, the people around me got really suffered a lot from that. And my recovery ripples out as well.
And a lot of people have benefited from it.
For sure. And I like to say that with some humility, right? Because I get told a lot how helpful I've been and what, you know, and it's like, I just want to thank Chick, my sponsor, like, because on my own, I'm like, and I'm becoming more of that guy. Like it's a little more of a default to be helpful than it used to be.
But the reality is Chick sat down and went over the 12 steps with you and read the big book, and somebody on the outside would be, why would this guy do this?
What?
Because he's getting help himself by doing that.
For sure.
It's part of the service. You know what I mean? You feel better about yourself when you're helping somebody else out. So you'd like to say it's altruistic, you know what I mean? But it's, I mean, like people go, why do you do this podcast? I go, because you have no idea what it's doing for me too. It's keeping me sober. It's keeping me rooted in a community. It's keeping me humble. And that's what I love about it. You know, the fact that it gets to help out all these other people is just amazing. And I love it. But
it's amazing.
Yes.
Another therapist that I know who I respect a lot, he put it this way. He said the ripples flow both ways. Mm. He's like, when you get out there and you make you take your abilities, whatever they are, and you do good, whether it's in, you know, a service-oriented way or a clinical way or whatever it is, those ripples go out and they affect other people and they start to ripple. But those ripples flow back too, because we benefit as we put it out there. And so it's a beautiful dance, sort of, that it goes both ways. And like Casey said, I had no idea. You know, I've been working as a psychologist here in Salt Lake for 20 years now. And I had no idea until we started this show how many ripples are out there in our community from people in recovery. It's just amazing. If they might be the biggest group as a group that are doing that sort of thing in our community and not getting paid for it. This is all the volunteerism, the philanthropy, the get up early, stay up late kind of behaviors that they do to help other people.
The late night phone calls, the jail cell
visits.
And
it's not... I wouldn't trade it for the world. I go to the jail on Tuesday nights and bring AA into the jail. This is for sure the most public I've ever been about it right this moment, and I don't love saying that. But I do that for me.
Yeah.
I hope it helps those guys.
Yeah.
But the guy I go with, and we went for probably 5 years together before the pandemic and have just started going back recently, we become best friends. I didn't know. He's much younger than me, has a different life than I do. I didn't know that was in it for me. And then we see guys get out and say, thanks for that meeting you brought to jail. And they're sober now. And it's amazing.
Well, you have to be willing to plant seeds, right? And we don't always know what we're doing. And it may seem like we didn't make a difference one day or nobody really heard the message one day. But those seeds get planted. And you have to be willing to never see those trees grow, but have faith that they're out there.
Yeah, and I like to remember that people are watching us. They're like the people that I work with and that my clients and people in AA, and I'm a very active AA guy, and I sponsor guys, and I don't get paid, and I don't care about that. I get paid at my job.
Yeah.
And people are watching, and because I was watching them, like, how do you be a good sober son? It was really important to me. I really wanted to be a good kid. Mm-hmm. It was not a very easy son, I'm sure. And my dad passed away a few years ago, and I told you earlier, I took a lot of money from him and a lot of his safety and well-being, and I was with him when he took his last breath, and I felt all the way clean with him, and I think he felt clean with me. And of all the money, I was the executor of his estate.
Oh, he put you in charge, huh?
And my sisters were like, well, of course you are. I'm like, I still have that little... voice that's like, you're a dope fiend, you're a drug addict, you're a loser, you're a thief. I'm not any of those things. I have been, but I was really quite touched that he would consider that.
It's a beautiful gesture.
He didn't see those other things.
Right.
It's a gesture of trust. He knew who you would become.
So it's quite a journey. I was thinking about all the suicidal talk, and I don't know who's listening to this, and I know that's sort of a secret, quiet thing, and I was thinking how grateful I am that I didn't kill myself, that I would have killed the wrong guy. I would have killed this guy, not that sad, mopey, depressed guy. And
how profound is that?
That's a wonderful way to think of it. Yeah.
In May, and I wanted just a little public service announcement for Mental Health Awareness Month.
Yeah, coming up.
I don't know if that's a sponsor here, but
no, we should be.
It doesn't need to be May for mental health awareness, and I'm a mental health professional. And I want to just say, like, go talk to somebody.
There's the Safe UT app. There's
Live
numbers.
On. Yeah. My wife is very active with Live On, and nobody would be better off if you were dead, for sure. And please find someone to talk to. I just feel compelled.
One of the things, I didn't mention it when you were talking about your suicidal thoughts and those intrusive thoughts, that term you used, it's delusional. And I've talked to so many people, as I'm sure you have, who have said, I really did think people would be better off without me. I really believed that. And now I look back on that and I think, how could I have thought that? That's the power of depression.
Correct.
And mental illness and substance abuse, that it changes the way your brain functions to the point where your brain can convince you of things that aren't true. But I echo what you say. Nobody is ever better off. In fact, everyone's worse off when a person leaves and takes their life.
I've heard people say when a family member or a loved one or somebody commits suicide, the, you know, the old school thought was like, I can't believe they took the easy way out, or they get mad at him. And I go, you got to stop.
Very judgmental.
And you got to throw some empathy in there. That's how bad it was.
Yeah.
That they thought this was their best ID or best option.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? That's how powerful depression is. That's how powerful substance abuse is. That's how powerful addiction is.
Yeah.
And so, you're right. Go
and
out.
I think if we don't talk about it, we're in real trouble. And I like when we talk, like, you're going to therapy. I've gone to therapy for 20 years of my life. I do therapy. I don't, like, if not to learn how to live life, to maybe find one other human being you could be honest with and transparent and vulnerable with. The value of that is unmeasurable, I think, that the secrets we keep, that I couldn't tell my partner this, or I don't want my neighbors to know this, that you could tell a stranger, a therapist, the value of that, I think, is, there's no value on that.
When you were told to go downstairs and get on your knees and pray, I don't know what you prayed for, but I have a feeling that's the first time you've probably ever said everything out honestly and open.
Right.
Well, you know what I mean? And freed your body from, and that's why, but that's just me guessing.
No,
you know,
and I mean, listen, I'm a 12-step guy. I'm a God guy. I'm a prayerful guy. I don't want to promote any of that here because we don't promote that, but it is, my life has transformed as a result of those steps. And the process of the steps is not to help you stop drinking. It's to help you find a power greater than you that can help you with your life. And I found, like, I've got that in my corner.
Yeah. I tell people I got sober to live, not sober to hide.
And I would say that recovery is about an abundant, rich, very full life. It is not about, well, I can't go camping anymore, can't go to concerts right. anymore. I wasn't doing any of that stuff really before because I was hiding out in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And my life is just a little, like, so last year, I took my family, my wife and two kids we flew into Edinburgh, Scotland. On Father's Day, my son and I played St. Andrew's Golf Course.
Oh, yes.
And that night we went and saw Elton John in Sunderland, England, in Northern England. Father's Day, a Sunday.
Wow.
Spent the week in London, and the next Saturday we saw the Rolling Stones at Hyde Park in London.
Holy cow.
And that's the kind of stuff I would have dreamed of, and I would have never done not sober.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a week of my life, right? That's 12 days. And I got a lot of those stories. And I know a lot of dudes that have a lot of those stories of we're living big lives. Sober, I can do anything I want.
Yeah.
Not sober, I couldn't do anything I wanted to do.
And that's the power of recovery.
It looks differently, right? It looks like when you said the delusion of, well, it's going to be lame and boring and dull being sober.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out I was already lame and boring and dull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
did that already.
This is rich. This is full. I want to just say there's a life of recovery out there that's really nice.
Well, this has been one of my favorite episodes. And if you've liked.
I hope you say that every time.
I don't.
No.
You should.
I don't. And I want to say thank you for sharing your story, Mark. And if people like what they heard from you and would like to get in touch with you, you can find him at Steps Recovery. Right?
Yeah.
And reach out. And if you're
Have a website?
You don't have to come to treatment to reach out to me.
Well, I'm glad you said that because, you know, Dr. Matt talks about it. It's like when all of a sudden the loved one in your family who needs help, you call a recovery center during the crisis, which you should. But there's no problem with calling these recovery centers ahead of time and going, hey, I'm just trying to get ahead of this. I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know how bad it is.
Or even just get a therapy appointment and say, I've wondered if I have depression, or I've wondered if I have a problematic relationship with alcohol. Like, I don't know. And I'm embarrassed to talk to my wife, or I'm embarrassed to talk to my friends about it. But you know what? Therapists, whether they're at a recovery center or another place, they'd love to talk to you about that. They'd say, well, let's break it down. Let's get to know you.
Right. And I would never diagnose any. It's interesting because substance use disorders, we diagnose them.
Mm-hmm.
And you only seem to be able to get work done on them if you diagnose that.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to agree with the diagnosis, right? It's kind of a self-diagnosed. I probably had an alcohol use disorder much before I got sober.
Yeah.
And so, I'm here to help. We're here to help. You like?
It's I love just, it.
Yeah.
What is your favorite part of Mark's story?
Mark painted a visual picture for me, and I didn't want to interrupt the story and comment on it then, but I'll comment on it now. So probably most of the people listening are familiar with the geography of the state of Utah. But if you're not, Utah, Salt Lake City is nestled in these beautiful high mountains. We have the best skiing in the world. And then you come down and you have this beautiful valley, the Salt Lake Valley. And Mark, you went from living at the top of the avenues. And for the people that don't know, that's pretty far up on the mountain here. Up, you're up above the city and you see everything. It is one of the most beautiful views in the world. And then you went down to live homelessly at Pioneer Park, which is down in the valley. And that fall from going up so high to going down so low. And my thought was he didn't even realize that he'd stepped all the way down because he was still saying it's not too bad. And I thought, boy, if you could just measure the badness in feet, there are hundreds of them. But now you've transcended that again. And I just feel like that visual has stuck with me since you mentioned that. And the transcendence of, like, you know, where are we at in our lives? Are we down low? Are we up high on the mountain? And what does it take to get us up there? And I think you've painted a beautiful picture for us today on that. So that's thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for stopping by. I appreciate it. You know, he's a heavyweight in the recovery world.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
been an honor to hear your story and get to hear you talk a little bit about your journey and all the wonderful things you're doing now. So thank you very much.
Thanks,
very
Mark. Much.
And thank you for stopping by and listening to another episode of Project Recovery. It's brought to you by our friends at Reprieve Recovery. Go check them out online, reprieverc.com. That's where you can find out more about them. Without them, we wouldn't be able to do this podcast weekly. So thank you to them over there. And thank you for stopping by. In case you forgot, Project Recovery is what?
It's a KSL podcast.
Yeah.
I got it right this week.
You did good.
Yeah, thanks.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.